This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Hello and welcome. It's 18th of March 2025. I'm Alec Hogg with the BizNews briefing. Well, we woke up this morning to notice that Bronwyn Nielsen's interview with Joel Pollack that was conducted yesterday has hit the global media. The prestigious Times of London has run a strong report there on it today. The Times picked up on Pollack's warning to Bronwyn that Johannesburg's proposed renaming of Sandton Drive will have severe and broad economic impact on South Africa and perhaps even on the continent. Here's the relevant section of that discussion, which now appears to be catching the international attention.
The purpose of renaming the street is an attempt to force the U.S. consulate to put the name of a Palestinian terrorist hijacker who only failed because she was stopped by other people on the flight and air marshals who successfully prevented her from killing innocent civilians. They want her name on the letterhead of the United States of America. That will never happen, and it's going to be met with a very stern response. I don't know why South Africa would want to name any street after a hijacker. I understand that there are different perspectives on the tactics used during the liberation struggle and so forth. But you have to understand, and I'm sure you do understand, that South Africa has a bit of an image problem when it comes to ordinary crime, never mind international relations. And Johannesburg is known, or has been known in the past, for, unfortunately, armed hijacking of passenger vehicles. When Americans come to the country, they understand that. When they come to South Africa, they understand there's a risk, there's high crime. Why would you amplify that risk and those fears by naming one of the most important streets in Johannesburg after a hijacker? They've cast this as some kind of support for the Palestinians. It also doesn't help them either, because they need to get past using violence and terrorism. They need to start doing some real peacemaking, institution building. Otherwise, they're just going to keep moving backwards. But aside from that, the South African economy is not well served by advertising the violent crime problem by renaming a major thoroughfare after a hijacker, whether it's an airplane hijacker or a car hijacker. It just does not work. And so the consulate, I think, is in peril if you do that. But also, Sandton is in peril. I mean, the central hub of the South African economy, South African finance, African finance, is going to be undermined by this ridiculous move. And by the way, I watched the Johannesburg City Council debate over this, and the bigotry on display, the anti-Semitism, the attacks on a Jewish speaker, frankly, were disgusting. I haven't really heard condemnation of those either. So if you want people to invest in South Africa, you are really sending the wrong message, if you don't mind me saying so.
What does it mean if the consulate is closed? The actual hard facts. So translate that for the average South African. The U.S. consulate is closed in Johannesburg. What does that mean?
Well, again, I should stress I'm not speaking officially for the Trump administration, but what it would mean is that South Africans who need consular services, whether it's visas or other things, would have to go elsewhere. They'd have to go to the embassy in Pretoria or the consulate in Cape Town. But the United States will not be located on a street named for a terrorist. It will not happen. So I'm given to understand that the city manager in Johannesburg has the final say, that despite the very lopsided nature of the vote in the Johannesburg City Council, there is some procedure by which this can be stopped. And as someone who would like to see relations between South Africa and the United States improve and would like to see the South African economy grow and create jobs, including union jobs, I would strongly encourage South Africans to rethink this decision, because it does mark a downward spiral, I think, for the Johannesburg financial sector and for Sandton, and probably for the country and the continent. If that's what South Africa wants to embrace, Americans want no part of it. And I think you can understand why.
Joel Pollack is the front runner to be the next U.S. ambassador to South Africa. So although he does not speak for the Trump administration, you can be sure that he's echoing what Washington is thinking about this. And you've got to wonder at what point Do the politicians realize that they're there to serve the people, not to destroy jobs and to destroy economic prospects, just in the basis of their own ideology? Man, this first level thinking just, well, gets my goat. On to the BizNews conference last week, and our opening address was by Helen Ziller, the federal chair of the Democratic Alliance. It was a forceful address, and what followed in the Q&A section was even more forthright. In this clip from her Hour of Power, Ziller explains what happens next with the national budget now that the DA, which is in coalition with the ANC, has actually voted against it. So what happens? When will the budget go through? And indeed, does it mean the end of the government of national unity?
Yesterday, I spoke to the lawyers and I asked them to map out an entire trajectory for me. There are a number of votes that have to happen. There is, as everybody knows, the appropriation vote, in which every single departmental vote is debated in Parliament and then voted on individually. And then the budget as a whole has to be voted on and debated. And that's a very tough debate. And after that comes the Division of Revenue Act, which is a very important one. The Division of Revenue vote in Parliament decides how the money is going to be distributed between the national government and the nine provinces. And at every one of those, we can decide to vote for if we've got the concessions we're demanding, or we can withhold our vote again. So down these series of crucial votes that'll follow for at least 3 to 4 months, and then you've got the appropriation at the very end of the year, the adjustment budget, as we call it. At every one of those, we can flex our muscle, we can hold firm, we can say no until we get the concessions we want. We're in a much stronger position now than we were with Bella, or that we were with NHI, or that we were with EWC. But I'm sure we'll win a lot on the fights that we're still putting up on those three.
From what you said now and what you said from the podium, it sounds like coalition politics begins today or begins here.
Yes, coalition politics requires that you have muscle. You can't win everything, but you've got to win some things. And to have muscle, you've got to hold the balance of power. So there are lots of smaller parties. There are 10 parties that have been bought into this government of national unity. But without being rude to any of the rest of them, it doesn't really matter what they think and say because they don't have the balance of power. It matters what the DA says because we can defeat a vote in Parliament. We've got 87 votes in Parliament that the ANC can't get a majority without unless it brings in the EFF plus all the smaller parties or MK. And it doesn't look as if they'll be able to do that on the budget right now. So our vote really matters. And that is where coalition politics really begins.
We've all seen the cartoons of Donald Trump playing chess and Cyril Ramaphosa playing draughts on the same board. How do your negotiations with the ANC stack up? Are one of you playing chess and the other one draughts?
You know, I never know whether the ANC is being inconceivably devious or whether they are just totally incompetent. And it's a toss-up between the two, probably a combination, actually. I mean, let me give you an example. I was negotiating the terms of reference for the clearinghouse mechanism, which is supposed to be a conflict resolution mechanism within the government of national unity. And these discussions were happening last Friday. And of course, on the very morning the negotiations happen, all the papers arrive, always on the morning. And then 20 minutes before the negotiation was supposed to begin, another paper arrives in the inbox. And if it wasn't for my eagle-eyed office manager, Janine Skull, spotting that coming in, I wouldn't have even have read it before we started the meeting. And slipped in one of those sub-clauses was a proposal to remove the sufficient consensus clause of the DA that we had negotiated in the statement of intent. The most important clause for us. Now, I don't know if they are just totally incompetent and cannot get things together until 20 minutes before the meeting, or whether that is entirely deliberate and they wanted me to miss it, and then they could say, well, we sent it. And when we said, has everybody accept the terms of reference? And I'd said, yes, that would have been me. So you've got to be on your toes the whole time. You've got to read all the documents. And another great thing the ANC does is you read all the documents and they make you think you're making progress. And 5 minutes to midnight, they produce a totally new document that they want to slip through from pressure from the president. And we're not playing that game anymore.
The era of coalition politics should be pretty exciting if you happen to be in parliament. If you're outside, well, it's interesting and let's hope that they act in a mature manner. But it has begun, as Helen Ziller mentioned there, that full hour of her address to the BizNews conference and the Q&A thereafter is now available on the BizNews channel on YouTube, as is the hour of Dan Morricani, the chief executive of Eskom, which in itself was pretty inspiring for many reasons. What we're going to be doing over the next 3 weeks is publishing two a day. It's quite a process for our production team to put these recordings together, but you can expect two fresh publications per day from the BizNews conference, and that'll be going over the next 2 weeks. Getting back to Morricani, he was telling us that Eskom is gearing up for a very different future. No more state funding and big opportunities that are available that they can take advantage of so that then they can repay all of the debt that is sitting on the Eskom balance sheet. Morricani used data to make the point that Eskom is not overstaffed, a big surprise to most South Africans looking at it, and it actually needs more people in the key area of generating electricity. Let's listen in.
It goes without question that the irritation that is Eskom going back to the fiscus now and again is just no longer tolerable by society. It's a fair point. I mean, the Minister of Finance today is juggling balls, touching up on VAT here and there, looking at where to get money to run some of the social programs or programs that needs to fund programs that are quite important for the country. And at the same time, SOEs like ourselves keep on going back and asking for money. We do look forward to the last part of our financial package out of this, and our intention is to not go back to the state. We're doing everything that we need to deal with to ensure that we do not get to that point. And how we do that is, first of all, to make sure that operationally we perform. We have the lights staying on, we have electricity that we can sell, we keep our costs down, and the next battle that we're going to go into now is collect for the sales that we make from municipalities that do not pay us. We don't sleep. We spend a lot of sleepless nights, and sometimes we have to be reminded that it's a Monday and not a Sunday or weekend, because we're really going through on this. We have tasted how it feels to have no load shedding for 311 days. We have witnessed the mood changing in the country. We have seen the perception of the country from an investment perspective change. I spent time on investment roadshows in New York and in London late last year, September or so, and the message is beginning to sink. We need to get to a point where this is no longer an issue from an investment perspective. But we also have to deal with issues around driving an ethical high-performance culture. We have changed our structures internally to ensure that we can bring accountability to bear. Where there's been wrongdoing, that there are actions being taken. We're working with the SIU. We've got other agents of the state that are actually doing work with us. There's a number of forensic work that was done in the last 2-3 years. Those files, as they come now, they arrive in a very focused team that takes decisions and disciplinary actions to employees and to also suppliers, because we also have to address these issues of around accountability and clean governance for our people. But for me, I tell you, we take our responsibility very seriously, and I'm very proud to work for Eskom at this point, given what it means for our country.
It sounds like a balancing act, but yeah, the world is changing, so I guess you're going to balance or rebalance as you need to. Ryan the Lion, hey, your tariff increases are unrealistic. Why can't you cost your costs? Would you agree that you have far too many employees?
Let me tackle the issue of too many employees, because it's been in the media for many years, and I've chastised my team for actually not being vocal about it. I think they've been beaten so much in the media that they don't want to defend this. But I'm going to make it easy for you, Alec, to understand. The World Bank study looked at comparative utilities in Europe and the US, and looked at the number of employees per megawatt generated by those entities. So the number that was shown as benchmark is in relation to the megawatt generation. And you actually normalize that to the number of employees that we have. In our business, the biggest number of employees sit where? In a distribution business. The distribution business, when you account for it in a manner that they wanted to do the adjustments, has a lot more kilometers of lines that they're looking after, because after 1994, we went on an aggressive program as a country to electrify the country. So we got a much more wider network that we are covering. And the World Bank study missed that. The paper was written. There's a guy who's got his PhD based here in Cape Town, in our team, who did all this work, published it, but it's been very quiet. Journalists don't like these things because these are facts and the truth. You can't move away from them. But that's the point. We are not overstaffed. And I'll tell you this. If you look at the staff complement for Eskom, and you know, there's a famous VGB report that was issued last year by National Treasury. VGB is an association of power utilities headquartered in Germany. It does benchmarks. One of the things that came out of the VGB report, other than the fact that Eskom did not have the right processes for procurement, they're cumbersome, they're too bureaucratic, one of the things they pointed out was that Eskom generation was understaffed. You only have to look at the last 5 years or 6 years of the number of intake of young engineers into Eskom. You can see a clear decline, almost from a linear approach to an absolute drop. Why? Because the message that got to the business was that you are overstaffed, and therefore there was no investment in your timber in terms of growing your own timber internally. The end result is that 2 years ago, we then realized that we don't have the right skills in the business, not enough skills in the business. That's why business has come closer to support Eskom with additional resources through the Workstream 1 of the NICOM process, and we've gone back into a recruitment process. It is this messaging that is inaccurate that led the business to really getting to a point of making wrong decisions going forward here. But I'm comfortable that those numbers, we can actually back calculate them and show how they compare with the rest in the utilities.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking, out of the ordinary.
So interesting, isn't it? Then you get the wrong message out into the society and suddenly everything gets put out of kilter there. One guy gets his numbers wrong, doesn't bring in the distribution staff, and as a consequence, we all sit back and say, Eskom has been overstaffed. And indeed, Alan Gray put out a very famous statement on this some time ago, and it still resonates with society. Well, as I mentioned to Dan Marocani, it's a good idea to pick up on that and to actually put the real facts out there whenever you see the incorrect ones. Again, that full interview is on BizNews TV. Well, moving to the international scene now, it feels like a lifetime ago in 2018 when Cyril Ramaphosa gushed about Chinese entrepreneur Jack Ma. You might recall that was at South Africa's 2018 investment conference in Sandton, where Ramaphosa said that Ma was a hero, as were other entrepreneurs. Well, it was only 18 months after that Ma disappeared, and this was after he had made some critical comments about Beijing. Alibaba, his company, tanked. The share price fell far, but recently it's been recovering, And indeed, Jack Ma appears to have been rehabilitated by Beijing. Here's our colleagues, our partners at the Financial Times of London, who had the story today on the FT News Briefing.
Jack Ma was once seen as China's poster child for the tech wonder. Alibaba at its peak was valued at more than $700 billion, and it's one of the most valuable companies in the world, not only in China.
But a clampdown by Chinese regulators sent the company's shares spiraling, and Alibaba struggled for years.
Many people would point to the failed Ant Financial IPO in 2020. So Ant Financial was set to raise $34.5 billion from the world's largest IPO around that time, and it was called off at the very last minute. Regulators later said it was because Alibaba had some shortcomings that they have discovered, but it was actually because Jack gave a speech a few days before the listing, and he was talking about China's banking system and how it was operating like pawn shops. So that really made Beijing angry, and that caused a lot of political issues.
The e-commerce giant had to pay a lot of hefty fines, and Jack Ma faded from view for a while, until recently. Now, there are signals that the tech wonder might be back on Beijing's good side.
Well, a key signal was earlier this year when Jack Ma was at a meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. So he was sitting in the front row together with other businessmen like Tencent's Pony Ma and a few other significant Chinese business people. So that was seen as a symbolic move from Beijing to show people that Jack is now politically safe. And also that's a sign seen by market as Jack coming out of his political exile.
And it looks to be all thanks to Beijing's interest in artificial intelligence.
Alibaba started investing into AI-related research as early as 2019, but their serious investment really started after Jack saw the potential of AI after ChatGPT was launched, which is also in line with Beijing's strategy to use AI to help the economy, which is slowing down.
It's not just Jack Ma, though. Alibaba is on the up and up again, too.
So Alibaba's Q1 model, which is as open source as DeepSeek's models, is actually seen as one of the most advanced models from China, especially the latest version. It's a very small model, and it's basically performing almost as good as DeepSeek, but with even lower cost. It's more efficient. Investors have realized how advanced Alibaba has become in terms of its AI capability, which is why Alibaba stock rose almost 70% this year. And this is after DeepSeek's release of its R1 reasoning model. And that's the moment when investors realize Chinese tech overall have been significantly undervalued.
Zijin Wei is the FT's Asia tech correspondent.
Fascinating, isn't it, the way that the world is developing and the whole AI story making enemies into friends. Well, still with China and with our overseas partners, this time with Bloomberg, one of the best performing companies in that country is BYD. I recall being at a Berkshire Hathaway AGM more than a decade ago when Charlie Munger said this was a stock that he had owned and indeed recommended others purchase it. Well, if only we'd listened to Charlie, the late Charlie Munger, because BYD continues to steam ahead. Here's a piece from our partners at Bloomberg on the big breakthrough on battery technology.
In fact, we just took out the recent high is BYD, 4.5% at about 403. We're coming off highs a little bit, but I believe we should still be above the pre-cash call level there intraday. Let's bring in Danny Lee to tell us really what's going on here and all the bullishness around the stock here. Tell us about this BYD event.
Yeah, so BYD, the investors are reacting to an event last night, BYD hosting, showcasing ultra-fast charging cars, a whole new lineup of models that we're based on, much more powerful, robust batteries, but critically with super-fast charging that basically gives you the same amount of range or power in 5 minutes in the same time it takes to charge a gasoline car. So it's a whole new suite of tech and infrastructure that BYD is banking on to really accelerate the sales of its fully electric EVs, particularly as it made upgrades to its plug-in hybrid models last year, and that itself saw sales soar. So this is a huge bet on them for them to try and really elevate sales even further.
EVs, electric vehicles, and the challenge, of course, is Tesla, but you can be sure Tesla will be coming back with something similar. Isn't that interesting? So you can charge up your battery or your electric vehicle in the same time as you charge up your internal combustion engine with petrol or diesel. Still with the Musk empire, astronauts rescued from the space station. They were supposed to go for 8 days. They ended up going for 9 months by Musk's company, SpaceX. Here's the story from Bloomberg.
NASA's two stuck astronauts, probably struck about the fact that they were stuck for so long, are heading back to Earth, closing out a dramatic mission that began more than 9 months ago, but was supposed to last just 8 days. For more, let's bring in Bloomberg's Bill Ferries. Bill, this has all been happening as we've been on air. What is the latest?
Well, the latest is that Butch Wilmore and Suni Williams are two of the four astronauts on the SpaceX capsule that has departed the International Space Station. It is orbiting into position to come through the Earth's atmosphere. It's expected to parachute into the waters off the coast of Florida just around 6 a.m. New York time. And it, as you mentioned, it comes after the pair have spent almost basically 9 months in space after expecting to go up for just an 8-day journey.
What are you watching for next then? I mean, this is a fascinating story on so many levels, at the human level, but also politically. It's become a bit of a political football, it seems. You've got SpaceX involved, you've got NASA, you've got challenges at Boeing. What are the kind of broader takeaways from what is a dramatic human story?
Yeah, so first of all, on the human front, the astronauts will get picked up, they'll get a medical check, and they'll be whisked off to Houston to meet with their family. On the bigger front, there's going to be a lot of questions going forward. First of all, about Boeing, the problems it had with its Starliner craft put a really a big spotlight on some of the challenges their unit that focuses on space exploration is having. And then, of course, this did get wrapped up in politics like everything seems to do, with Elon Musk and the Trump administration essentially accusing the Biden administration and NASA of having abandoned these astronauts after some problems with that Starliner spacecraft. So we'll look to see if that's still playing out. But I think Boeing, there's going to be a lot of questions about its future in the space business and NASA, whether it can hit. Always wanted two competing platforms to be able to always have a plan B in case of these emergencies. If Boeing is not able to serve that role reliably, it's going to raise questions about the U.S. government's increasing dependence on SpaceX.
Well, who wants to be called going like a Boeing anymore? This is your Biz News Briefing. We'll be back again same time tomorrow. Until then, cheerio. This Biz News Briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to private banking service now for your business.